This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Doctor in the House, brought to you by AIA Vitality.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasothi. It's our Health and Living segment and I have Dr. Derek Yach in the studio with me, Chief Health Officer and Senior Vice President of the Vitality Group. He has a very interesting career focused on advancing global health. Presently, he's the, as I mentioned, Chief Health Officer and Senior Vice President of the Vitality Group, but he also serves on several advisory boards, including those of the Clinton Global Initiative and the World Economic Forum. But previously, a very colorful career indeed. He was Senior Vice President of the Global Health and Agriculture Policy at PepsiCo, a Professor of Global Health at Yale University, and Executive Director for Non-Communicable Diseases and Mental Health at the World Health Organization. We're going to find out what he's taken away from all these stints with these various organizations. Welcome to the show, Derek. How are you today?
Great. Thanks, Meera. Real pleasure to be here.
Derek, where did you start off when you left school? What were your interests? Because it's obviously centered around health, but in very different organizations, motivations driven by a whole load of varying issues. Where did this interest in health come about?
Well, I grew up in apartheid South Africa, and as students, we always asked the question, how can we have the biggest impact in what was then an apartheid government regime? And I always felt that medicine and public health were an area where I could actually have some impact and where there'd be a need in a post-apartheid era that we all realized would come soon.
Mm-hmm. And when you were growing up in that sort of environment, how did you feel?
Well, I think you felt, I felt certainly that the level of injustice and human rights abuse was unacceptable. My parents' friends really allowed me to grow up being a white in an environment where we knew that this was just an unacceptable way forward. And many people are unaware of the fact that there was strong white opposition to apartheid right from the beginning. So it was a constant discourse. And even in my high school years, we were talking about the importance of change and how you're going to bring about change. And of course, experiencing the daily oppression of police during our school years and then during our early university years.
So you went on to do medicine?
I went on to do medicine almost by default. I can't say that I had this grand burning desire to be the great clinical doctor. In fact, fairly soon into my medical career, it became very clear that my passion lay in prevention and health promotion, not that much in clinical medicine. So much so that one of my mentors, who became one of the first deans in the post-apartheid era, one day said to me, Derek, it's actually in the best interests of patients that you don't go into clinical medicine.
You couldn't have been that bad.
And I went off to do prevention.
Okay. And from there, where did you first start? Where was your first stint?
I think the first real opportunity I had, again, was within the South African political reality at the time, that it's always difficult to imagine that the laws forbade black South Africans from coming into the cities. And I got told at the Medical Research Council, where I was an epidemiologist, by my boss, that they were going to change the laws. And I was asked to lead an effort to look at what would be the health consequences for people moving from rural to urban areas. And out of that, we created the National Center for Epidemiological Research in South Africa and a major program on urbanization and health, which really started looking at the multiple issues that face people as they move from rural to urban areas, the decline in infectious diseases, and of course, the rise of chronic diseases. Mm-hmm.
I can imagine there's still a lot of work to do in South Africa, but you moved on from there.
Yes. So during those years, South Africa was not a member of the World Health Organization. And by the middle of the 90s, they regained their membership. And I landed up being the first South African asked to rejoin the World Health Organization after 30 years.
And that's where you were the executive director for NCDs and mental health?
So I first led an initiative which culminated in a treaty on tobacco control. And as we were expanding that, we also increased the focus on other risk factors for health, and the chronic disease programs. It also included the focus on mental health as well.
Mm-hmm. You headed that initiative on tobacco-free. I don't think we've progressed very much, actually.
Well, I think globally we've seen progress, and you know, later we can talk about what we see in the next frontier. But it was actually the first time that there'd been a legislated approach to tobacco control, which over the last decade or so has meant that most countries in the world have actually signed up. We're slowly seeing taxes go in the right direction, not in every country, of course. But the reality is we have over a billion people who smoke every year, and we have 6 million who die every year of tobacco. So it's hardly a success yet.
Okay. And you feel very strongly about e-cigarettes, vaping. Malaysia has taken the stand that, you know, e-cigarettes are a big no-no. But I do know in public health in the UK, they are, you know, they do accept it as a smoking cessation device, not really for you to pick up. I think here the concern is it's become a lifestyle problem, not as a smoking cessation alternative. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, being somebody who'd been so opposed to everything the tobacco industry did, it was quite an effort to look at the evidence properly and realize that what they were doing was separating the harm that tobacco causes, which is from the tar, from the addiction, which is nicotine. And if you took out the tar, you'd be lowering the deaths. And to my mind, that's my central interest, lowering the deaths. Most of the e-cigarettes available now and the new ones coming, as well as the other reduced risk products, heat not burn, non-combustible products, will probably reduce risks by 95%+. Now, as a public health person, that sounds like a really fantastic deal. And if you can get smokers to switch to these reduced risk products, which they are more likely to do than to get on nicotine replacement therapy or quitting, we can actually start making a serious dent in the predicted 1 billion deaths expected this century. 1 billion deaths. There's no other major intervention in public health that could have such a big yield. The concern many governments have, and I imagine the same here, is first they think it's a trick by the industry to simply stay in business. Well, it is a way of them staying in the business, but it's not a trick. Second, I think there's such strong fear that this could be leading kids into first these products and then tobacco, for which there's very little evidence. That the evidence doesn't exist in the US or in the UK. So I think I think that you'll see over the next few years the approach that the government of England has taken, New Zealand more recently, and a few others, is likely, I hope, to become the norm. And we'll learn to live with what's called harm reduction, where you can't have the perfection of going from being a heavy smoker to doing nothing for many people because they are addicted. And remember that lifelong use of nicotine or nicotine replacement therapy actually doesn't confer many risks anyway. It's not as if it's a deadly product to be taken. So the addiction is fairly inert and fairly mild.
But do you not agree that there's still a lot about e-cigarettes that we don't know about?
There probably is, but I think you've always got to ask the question, what's the relative difference? What are we replacing? And we're replacing a known deadly product that kills half its consumers with products that may cut the risk by 95%. If it's not 95% and it's 90%, it's going to still be a massive gain for public health.
You've been, you know, charging ahead when it comes to prevention. It took the industry by surprise when you actually left WHO for PepsiCo. And I was reading that you had a very interesting conversation with Indra Nooyi, one of the leaders of PepsiCo. Obviously, that conversation must have been pretty impactful. What was the outcome of that, that you decided to quit the WHO and join PepsiCo?
Well, I was actually at the Rockefeller Foundation at the time, so working on global health. And I think many people here and around the world also associate Rockefeller with leadership in global health. But anybody who's met Indra Nooyi knows that she is passionate, serious, and one of the most amazing CEOs we have worldwide. And her pitch to me was very simple. I wasn't looking for a change in job, but she had just become the new CEO, and she laid out a vision of how a great food company in the future should be addressing undernutrition, as well as the persistent problems of obesity. To do it, she needed people on the inside to do what they were saying on the outside. And so I joined knowing that it wouldn't be me alone. There would be a whole research and development team that would be brought in. There would be partnerships built out. and that there'd be a chance to define a path for the company that would be transformative. And when I left after 5 years, I'd say we probably had achieved 65%, maybe 70% of what was set out to do. And 10 years on now from that first point, if you look at the portfolio in terms of salt and sugars and trans fats and healthy products, and I think the transformation is now unstoppable, particularly since the healthiest part of the portfolio, which is coming from hummus and oats and fruit and vegetables and nuts and grains, is actually the most profitable and fastest growing part of the portfolio.
Well, that's interesting, because the food industry, I mean, we talk about processed food and all of that, goes very much against public health, really. We're all into, you know, fresh food and fruit and veg and you know, meat and stuff. But then the food industry, it's the opposite. So what was the motivation to go in and make that change?
I think there were a few things. When Indra highlighted the fact that every day, 2 to 3 billion people around the world are touched by a PepsiCo product. And if you load the salt level in, for example, the Frito-Lay products that they sell worldwide, you'd be lowering sodium levels in 3 billion people. If you started shifting trans fats out, if you started moving out of palm oil into healthier oils, you would actually have an impact on cardiovascular health worldwide. So the scale and the impact of even a small change struck me as something profound. And then I looked at the impact on sustainable agriculture of what they were doing, providing not just technical support, but addressing a lot of the water issues, the sustainable farming issues. And it became a very attractive proposition compared to the struggle I'd had at WHO often to get governments to take action. And it's all very well to say, you know, industry is terrible and bad. But the reality is that governments are often far slower to act, even in the absence of pressure, simply because of inertia, lack of insight, lack of innovation.
And if you compare the tobacco industry, your exposures to the tobacco industry and the food industry, were you championing pretty much the same things at the end of the day?
Throughout my career, I've always remained, I believe, true to some very simple focus. Prevention is better than cure. Promoting health and healthy lifestyles is the way to do it. But what I've learned along the way is that it isn't the sole responsibility either of individuals or governments. Industry can play a role, and it can do it profitably. And the more it aligns its profitable motive with doing healthy things, as it's doing in the environment, the more we'll see accelerated change.
Mm-hmm. When we come back, I want to find out your thoughts on what will it take to change our perception of health? I mean, I think we understand it as a huge expense, and we want to minimize that expense. And that is really the perception at the moment going forward. But your thoughts on that coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In the studio with me, Dr. Derek Yach, Chief Health Officer and Senior Vice President of the Vitality Group. We're discussing his career path in global health, which is really his passion, health prevention, really at the core of all of this. The Vitality Group, it's a health insurer in South Africa. Why did you decide to shift to insurance?
I've been privileged to have inspiring leaders. I had Gro Harlem Brundtland at WHO, Indra Nooyi at PepsiCo. And when Adrian Gore came knocking, there was no question this was time for a new shift. So Adrian Gore, as the CEO, recognized 25 years ago that the insurance model was dull and boring and broken. And with a group of young actuaries, started asking an intriguing question. What happens if we actually do what we should be doing with life insurance, and that is promote life itself? How do we incentivize people to live healthier lives? And if we did that, would it actually lead to materially improvements in their lives? And if it did that, we would win as a company because they'd be paying for a longer period of time. They would win because they have extra life. And out of that came the Vitality model, which really incentivizes healthy behavior and uses a complex of behavioral economics and other measures. I had been struck by how little of that insight was actually being used in the public sector. So in joining, my interest was to see, well, how can we apply what we know about science even further? How can we build out the model to address some of the gaps in the program? And knowing that they were globalizing represented a chance to build on what I'd been working with on WHO.
Has it been much of a success in South Africa? Or is it a model that, the success of such a model is still yet to be seen?
I think it's an absolute success. The data is very clear. People who start getting onto Vitality have a higher probability of leading longer, healthier lives, of lowering their healthcare costs, of actually having a larger investment for themselves because of the reductions on their healthcare bills, their health insurance, and their life insurance. And this is not just on internal documents of the organization. Part of my work that built on stuff before was to publish it in peer-reviewed journals. And so some of the work around the power of the program has been based on 1 million people followed for many years in South Africa. Increasingly, we've been using U.S. data, following 100,000 recently in the U.S., looking inside the corporate sector to see that when you apply this in the corporate setting, in very large companies like McKesson, you see real returns to the bottom line in terms of healthcare savings, but you also see an uplift in morale and retention and productivity that the individual employees feel as well. And all of this is now grounded in, I think, pretty solidly accepted data.
When you talk about behavioral traits when it comes to, you know, people in general and their approach to health, what makes you think they would change behavior being incentivized the way it is at the moment? Smokers, for an example. What do you think? Do you think a program like this will incentivize people to stop smoking, for an example?
I would say in smoking, we've seen modest success, partly because I think we still have a little more theory to test. But you find that people who are given a financial incentive to quit have a much higher success rate at 12 months than those put on a traditional advice or cessation or nicotine replacement program. And that's based on clinical trials done in the U.S. within the workplace. General Electric put, you know, huge trials by the same team who work with us on designing our programs. But the real power of behavioral economics really starts with these very simple insights that we tend to act in our worst long-term interests. We tend to act in for our short-term gains, not because we are stupid or because we're dumb or just because we're people. And we have an inherent likelihood of taking the easy option, which tends to be more short-term. If you are faced with a range of foods and in front of you are sugary, sweet, whatever foods, people will take the easy option then picking up the fruit and vegetables, particularly if they're not available. If it's a miserable day in the morning, they're less likely to go out for a gym or a swim than they would be otherwise. And so our program takes people where they are and applies these behavioral economic realities and says, well, the incentives we put in place are not a bribe to get people to do things they wouldn't want to do. Most people want to lead healthy lives. They want to eat healthy foods. They want to be more active. They need a little bit of a nudge, a little bit of a push, a little bit of support. And that's what these programs do.
And did you find that the reward pathways in the brain is what got us going?
Very definitely. And we see that it becomes reinforcing. The more people start actually seeing the material benefits that they feel in their own lives, they start being attracted not just by the external rewards, but the internal pleasure that they're actually getting from leading healthier lives.
Interesting. And you were on the board of the Bill Clinton's Global Initiative. How did you happen? What was your role there? This is just going back a little.
Yeah, it was a real privilege. It was for almost 19 years of the Clinton Global Initiative, which, as you know, formally closed last year. My role was really as part of initially the health and the broader team to advise the initiative on a couple of things. One is, what would be the global health issues that lent themselves particularly to private-public innovation together? And with a particular focus on chronic diseases, since many of my colleagues at the time had really done so much in infectious diseases and vaccines. And then secondly, the part I really enjoyed was when you'd have a major company or a philanthropy who are part of the Clinton Initiative wanting to do good in the world through improving cancer or depression or whatever it is, yet they didn't know how. And so part of my work involved working with them to define how they could actually make an impact given what is actually going on elsewhere.
And you've always said innovation is key when it comes to public health. What's stopping innovation at the moment?
I think part of the problem is that so many of the way people get trained in public health is still dependent upon the old era of infectious diseases and undernutrition. not recognizing, well, they recognize, but not really acting on the fact that we're in a world now rich in technology options and rich with understanding about behavior that we didn't have before. That combination of technologies, whether it's wearables, personalized devices, taken with better insights about how behavior change happen, is creating a whole new opportunity for public health. And much of that innovation is starting in the private sector. And so I see the chance to start bridging the divide between the innovations that we do in Vitality, Royal Philips is doing, even companies as diverse as Qualcomm, Samsung, Apple are doing, now needs to bridge their way into the public sector. Yet the people in the public sector have historically come out of a training in infectious diseases, not in technology, not really aware of what is on the cusp of change. Yet when you look at the technology innovators, you're seeing spectacular ideas and innovations for promoting activity and better sleep patterns or healthier diets. That's eventually hopefully going to find its way into the training of the future public health workforce.
I think just research into human behavioral economics will help, isn't it?
That's critical.
What gets us, it's absolutely critical.
And in fact, in Davos this year in the World Economic Forum, we put out a joint report with them and a group of people for the first time highlighting the power of behavioral economics to have an impact on chronic diseases, which is basically saying, how can modern behavioral science influence our policies and actions better? And this is something which will be taken forward, particularly with governments, NGOs, and academia.
It makes absolute sense, but why has it taken us so long to realize this?
Inertia is huge, particularly in the health sector. I think we forget that when it comes to public health, innovation is really been very, they've been very slow adopters of innovation compared to many other sectors where it's been much faster. And of course, clinical medicine has been so dominant that the clinical innovations that we've had in better treatment, advanced operations and whatever, have often displaced the brightest and the best people from actually going into applying this in the public health sector.
Mm-hmm. And into prevention as well.
Exactly.
Rather than coming up with solutions. Conversations around healthcare is heavily politicized. Take for example, American politics at the moment. What are your views on that? Trump, in a way, when it comes to health, is frightening as far as I'm concerned. What are your thoughts on that at the moment?
If you look over the course of history, we certainly know that the U.S. has the most expensive, the most inefficient healthcare system in the world. So it's buying the least health with the largest amount of dollar investments. And I think Trump is simply one example of decades of investment in a fee-for-service system that has really undervalued the power of the public sector's ability to provide health for all in the ways in which most of the OECD countries have and have done so more efficiently and more effectively. I think he's really just the most explicit example we've seen lately. The reality is most people in America, what they seek and what they want is access to dependable, affordable healthcare. They still tend to undervalue prevention for the reasons we spoke about earlier. And that needs to be given greater attention. But our hope is that the experiments starting to happen at state level will start actually forcing a change at the federal level inevitably. But you're right, we're in a very dangerous period now. It's not just a danger for healthcare, but it's a danger for all science. If you look at the proposed budget for later this year, the National Institutes of Health, the Trump proposal is to give it the largest cuts in history. To cut out entirely a program which I know that Malaysians have benefited from called the Fogarty International Program, which has trained people in global health around the world. It's a tiny program, yet it's going to be cut because it has the word international, and under an American first policy, that is seen as unnecessary. Of course, we all know the reality is that investing in global health is outstandingly good value for the health of Americans and the world because we are living in a single globalized world.
You know, and then the argument is, what is really our priorities? Is it public health? Should it be put into research for new medicines and, you know, solutions for health issues? What do you think?
Well, I certainly think that the continued focus on seeking the magical cure for the rarest condition, which has a lot of public appeal, is unfortunately not the way to go if you really want to address the major big drivers of health and healthcare in the future. We know that there are a number of major causes of ill health linked to a couple of risks. Tobacco use, we spoke about, unhealthy diets, activity, and so on. These are not big complex things where the research doesn't exist. We're also seeing that, particularly with aging and longevity, we're seeing a set of new challenges arise that need to be addressed. It's no longer going to be cardiovascular disease and chronic lung disease. It's going to be dementia, mental health, and issues associated with people's mobility that are going to require research. That kind of thinking has yet to translate into research dollars.
And are those some of the challenges you foresee in the future as far as health is concerned?
Absolutely. You know, I was just down with my colleagues in Singapore, and Singapore, of course, is one of the oldest populations in the world now, reminding them that they have actually hit the peak of virtually every country in the world. A child of 10 today in Singapore has a 50% probability of making it to 100. Incredible. So the question is, what are the challenges they're going to face as they start hitting their fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth decade? Things we didn't really have to think about in the past. It was pure survival. Well, now it's quality of life. It's issues related to how you're going to be able to think and work and be mobile and be independent and stay at home. That's going to be the future research agenda of the world.
And do you see future health trends in your mind at the moment?
I think we will always have the persistent fear of a major infectious disease outbreak. And I think that strengthening our global surveillance and capability for the unexpected, Zika came out of nowhere. There will be more Zikas. There will be more HIV, AIDS, and Ebola. But those are things that we need to be prepared with because we don't know what's going to come. We know with great certainty what is going to come with increased longevity. And so putting some serious investment into these issues around the brain, into mobility, into how we structure our lives so that we maintain social interaction and social connectivity with old age. Those are things that really need to be given high priority.
So we need to change this perception of health that we have at the moment, that we need to minimize cost to ensure better health going forward. I mean, that's
exactly.
Really the amongst governments and all of them. On a people level, what will be your message on prevention, on global health? Because when you say global health, when you say public health, we always think it's not our problem. We always think it's a collective, you know, very large problem, which is none of our business. But we are public health, really.
Well, it starts with us. It starts with when you woke up this morning, did you look at the opportunity to do a little bit of activity, to choose the healthy option? What constrained you doing it? How can we make that simple choice in your home, for your family, for your kids? Those things multiplied every single day, that actually determines your life course and whether you will make it to 100.
And in terms of your hopes for the future of global health?
Well, I certainly hope that we will see a greater interaction between the private sector, the public sector, NGOs, and people on the ground, where they will recognize that health is a value which we all seek. And instead of talking about the cost of aging and the cost of healthcare, we should see this as a great triumph of development as we are able to have populations age. I think that as we start doing it, I feel very positive that some governments, some elements of the private sector, not necessarily just pharma as we always think of, but those coming from IT and new technologies are actually seeing health at the center of their long-term goals, because they know it's both good for business, but it's also going to be good and the demands of society.
You know, Derek, you're not all just talk, because you really walk the talk as well. I was reading that you swim and you absolutely love swimming. It's almost extreme swimming. Why is that?
I'm not sure whether it's a punitive ego, but
a sucker for pain.
I come out of a crate. My father was an Olympic swimmer.
Really? Was he?
And after starting to lose competitively, I realized the only way to have fun was to swim longer and longer distances offshore, so a lot of sea swimming. And yes, I swim daily, and I must say I was thrilled to start this morning in a spectacular pool in the middle of the city. Mm-hmm. I think it is I think once you get into it as a habit, it's, as we're saying, it's something I can personally do most days and look forward to doing every day. It's both good for the health of your body generally, but it's also good for the mind, and it also cuts you off from the world of all the constant communications for a period of time to allow you to reflect.
I was reading some of your articles, and I love how you reflect on the things that you do. I mean, something as simple as swimming. I mean, you swam in the Hudson River, and you wrote about that. You wanted to just share that with us as to how your thoughts, you know, filtered through just not the swim, but your environment and everything that was there.
Yeah, as I said, I've swum in interesting places, and I think if you're mindful of what you, where you are, you know, for many years I swam to Robben Island, aware that Nelson Mandela was a prisoner on the island. We had to get clearance to actually swim there, and it wasn't just a joke to do the swim. It was actually to think very carefully about the day when he would actually get off. He couldn't get off. Last year I did this swim from the Statue of Liberty to the World Trade Center with a group of people from around the world, from Mexico, the Philippines, a number of countries now on the list or being threatened by some of the refugee and immigration policies. And we all did the swim because that represented the route that so many people, millions, came into America for the spirit of freedom over the last few years. So the swim is obviously the backdrop, and it's also the part we like, but realizing where you're swimming and I think matters.
What's your takeaway from all of this? On a personal level?
Well, I think we all find ways in which we can balance our own lives. And for me, the mixture of being able to promote health must start with what I can do personally and do it the best I can. And that's where swimming fits into my life.
What would you have? Would you have a message for us?
I think my only message for people is to remember that every day you have an opportunity to make a decision that can influence your health for the rest of your life. Try and see what it will do to make that small step. Once you take the first step, you'll realize making the next step will be easier every day.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Derek Yach, Chief Health Officer and Senior Vice President of the Vitality Group, speaking to us about global health and his journey on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon, and we continue the Health and Living segment. Some updates coming your way about Parkinson's disease. Scientists now believe that they have found a way to treat and perhaps even reverse Parkinson's disease. They have reprogrammed cells already present in the brain, which sort of closely resemble dopamine neurons. And I have Professor Dr. Lim Shin Yang, a consultant neurologist, also trained in Parkinson's and movement disorders, on the line with me to help me understand this study a little bit more. Welcome, Dr. Lim. How are you today?
Hello, Mira. Very good, thank you.
What did you think of this study?
The results are quite interesting. What the scientists have done here is that they have engineered a certain type of brain cell called astrocytes into dopamine neurons. And they did this in mice as well as in human cells in vitro. That's to say, this is done in the laboratory. So what the scientists did essentially was a type of gene therapy where you use a virus to transfect the cells to take on new functions. And what they were able to achieve was to transform these astrocytes into dopamine.
Okay, so Parkinson's disease it involves a loss of nerve cells in parts of the brain, and then that leads to a reduction in a chemical called dopamine in the brain. And we all know dopamine is vital for regulating movement of the body. Do you think there were gaps in the study, though?
Usually with studies like this published in a very good journal like this, the gaps are not so much in the scientific methodology. It's more in terms of the application of the findings. You're quite right, for example, to point out that in Parkinson's, one of the major problems is a deficiency of dopamine in the brain due to a degeneration of dopamine-producing brain cells or neurons. So what the scientists are hoping to achieve in the future is replacement of those dopamine-producing brain cells. This dopamine deficiency is responsible for many of the features of Parkinson's disease, for example, stiffness and slowness of movement. But it has to be borne in mind that dopamine is not the entire story with Parkinson's disease, and patients have a variety of symptoms that are not just due to a deficiency of dopamine. So although this study has a lot of promise, we should keep in mind the limitations, even if this technology can be applied successfully to human patients.
Are you excited?
It is interesting, but nowadays, in this day of social media, a lot of findings are put out there, and you know, at the end of the day, we don't see it translated into clinical practice. So this is the problem.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, Professor.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Professor Dr. Lim Shin Yang, consultant neurologist, who's also trained in Parkinson's and movement disorders, sharing his thoughts on replacement cells to mend the damaged brain as far as Parkinson's is concerned. On The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Doctor in the House was brought to you by AIA Vitality, a health program that rewards your healthy choices. This program is presented by AIA, the real life company.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.